From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're so thankful for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendars, Sunday is the Orthodox Christian Feast of All Saints, and on Friday, Muslims observe Lailat al-Qadr. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics this week, legislators, responding to overwhelming voter demand for action on gun violence, continued to pursue disruptive tactics in the face of majority obstinacy. Led by civil rights hero Representative John Lewis, Democrats engaged in an unprecedented sit-in on the House floor, garnering widespread attention, but sadly, no vote. In a meeting with leading far-right religious leaders, GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump questioned the religious beliefs of Secretary Hillary Clinton. As usual, Trump insisted that we just don't know what his presumed opponent's faith is. It's remarkable how successful a campaign built on things he, quote, just doesn't know has been for a candidate who spends the rest of his time insisting that our current leaders are all too stupid to be in charge of the nation. A year after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that marriage was a constitutional right for same-sex couples, a new Gallup poll shows a significant jump in the number of people exercising that right. Today, nearly half of same-sex couples living together in this country have tied the knot. On Monday, the Council on American Islamic Relations and the Center of Race and Gender at UC Berkeley released a really important report titled Confronting Fear, Islamophobia and Its Impact in the U.S., 2013-2015. It identifies 33 core groups actively working to stoke fear and hatred of Muslims in America, with access to over $200 million in funding. Meanwhile, the Smithsonian Institute has announced a first-ever exhibit of the Quran for later this year. Rare and historic copies of the Muslim holy book, some dating back to the 7th century, are scheduled to be on display in Washington, D.C., starting October 15th. And on Thursday, in part thanks to attempts to fearmonger around issues of refugees and other Muslim immigrants, voters in the U.K. chose to leave the European Union. The decision creates widespread uncertainty about the stability of the remaining structure of the EU. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
We can no longer wait. We can no longer be patient. So today we come to the well of the House to dramatize the need for action. Not next month, not next year, but now, today.
A few months ago, we brought you the story of a gun violence summit at Andover Newton Theological School, bringing together faith and political leaders and activists. The ambitious gathering addressed both the challenges and possible strategies of moving forward on this life or death issue. Now, with lawmakers failing to act, even in the wake of Orlando, we'll get an update from Andover President Martin Copenhaver.
It's so easy for us who have been hurt by the conservative church to switch and be on the far left, and to spend our lives fighting back against the conservative church. And in fact, we become a fundamentalist of a different kind. But that binary and that dualism is the exact toxic thing that pushed us away to the
In the past couple of years, Brandon Robertson has emerged as a leading voice for including LGBT persons in the life of evangelical Christianity. The founder of the Revangelical Movement, Brandon has been with us a number of times on this show, and now with the delayed release of his book, Nomad, he's just back from a foreign speaking tour and will be with us once again on State of Belief Radio. But first,
all of your leaders are selling Christianity down the tubes, selling the evangelicals down the tubes. What you really have to do is you have to pray to get everybody out to vote for one specific person.
On Tuesday, Donald Trump met with the leading lights of the conservative Christian movement in this country, an event that moderator Mike Huckabee called a seminal moment and the turning point of taking Trump to the presidency. While a veteran of the moral majority movement, Mike Farris, labeled it the end of the Christian right. Now, one thing seems clear. Of the estimated 1,000 strong attendees at Trump's meeting, a number have been born again, ready to have their faith-based activism serve the Trump agenda rather than the other way around. I'm happy to be able to welcome investigative journalist Sarah Posner back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So, Sarah, what did you find most noteworthy about the event?
Well, it was the leakiest meeting of this sort that I have seen covering three election cycles of the religious right vetting Republican presidential candidates. The audio of the meeting was leaked to me and to other news outlets. That's how Yahoo News was able to provide the world with a transcript of it. The leakiness of it demonstrated just discontent with what was happening. I mean, I think the fact that audio of the meeting was leaked was intended by some of the attendees to expose what was wrong in their view with the meeting, that Trump was attempting to cater to this constituency and offering nothing but platitudes, really, and that many of them were accepting that and saying, perhaps if not outright endorsing him, saying that progress had been made in making Trump acceptable to religious conservatives. After the meeting was over, the Trump campaign released a list of people who had been appointed to an evangelical executive advisory board, whatever that means, right? And so that's not an outright endorsement. But some of the people on the list had already endorsed Trump long before, like Jerry Falwell Jr. and Mark Burns, a televangelist from North Carolina. But, you know, clearly if one hadn't endorsed Trump already, being on this advisory board was a clear signal, even if they weren't using the word endorse.
What about the attack on Hillary Clinton's religion?
Well, I think that, you know, in general, Trump's attacks on Hillary Clinton this week involved a lot of projection, right? So there was a lot of projection about her alleged corruption and her alleged unsuitability to be commander-in-chief and also her religion. You know, so it was funny to hear Trump say, well, we don't really know anything about Hillary's religion, which is so far from the truth. I mean, there's been so much ink spilled about her lifelong Methodism and even about her reaching out to the fellowship or the family and going to prayer meetings with them. I mean, the historical record on Hillary Clinton's religion and deep commitment to her Methodist faith is, there's a huge public record on that. There is not a public record on Trump's religion. I mean, it's very, very thin. I think that what he was trying to do there was trying to pull the same sort of thing that Republicans have hinted at for a long time about Obama, that he's not really a Christian, or maybe he's a Muslim, or maybe he's an atheist. I think it worked with the fever swamps with Obama, you know, who's also a Christian, but it doesn't really work with Clinton because there's no Jeremiah Wright tape. There's no birtherism. I mean, like, you know, she's like such a straight and narrow Methodist that it's laughable that he would attack her on that basis.
After what we heard from Trump on Tuesday, Sarah, I've got to wonder, is there any part of the Constitution that he actually agrees with?
So, you know, I think that Trump's biggest pander to this group was his discussion of the Johnson Amendment, which is the 1954 amendment to the Internal Revenue Code, which prohibits tax-exempt churches from using their tax-exempt resources to endorse political candidates. Now, this is a big deal with the Christian right. They charge that it's a violation of their free speech rights for pastors not to be able to endorse candidates. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is not about your free speech rights. You are perfectly free to actually go across the street from your church property and take out a bullhorn and endorse a presidential candidate. Mm-hmm. You just can't do it with tax-exempt resources. You can't do it on your church letterhead. Mm-hmm. You can't do it when you're giving a sermon in the pulpit. But you can go out in public and do it as a private citizen. There's no infringement on your free speech. It's really about regulating the use of tax-exempt resources for politicking. Mm-hmm. It seemed like of all the religious liberty concerns that the Christian right has, which include the Johnson Amendment, but also include things like contraception coverage and religious exemptions to LGBT rights and things like that, that the only one that Trump focused on was one that may impact his presidency or his quest for the presidency. So basically he was saying to them, the only religious liberty issue that I really care about here is whether you guys can endorse me or not. Mm-hmm. All the other stuff that you're concerned about, I'm not even going to talk about. And the fact that the people who came out of that meeting cheerleading for Trump didn't see through that was just sort of comical. Mm-hmm.
Could he honestly believe that there is a lack of religious freedom in this country, or was that just pandering to that specific audience?
Well, you know, here's a guy who has called for the blatant and unconstitutional violation of the religious rights of Muslims. So his understanding of what the actual religious liberty protections in the Constitution are is obviously deeply flawed. And to the extent that he understands the nuances of, you know, the contraception coverage cases and the religious exemptions and whether bakers and photographers should be permitted to refuse service to LGBT couples and that sort of thing, he evinces absolutely zero understanding of those issues from any political viewpoint. He exhibits no evidence that he understands that these have even been issues that have been litigated and talked about and been just the focal point of religious right activism for about 3 years. Mm-hmm. He demonstrates no knowledge of that, and so that's why I find it surprising that these religious leaders would just say, oh, he's on our side in religious liberty, mm-hmm. when all he's done really is talk about how when he's president, he'll make it okay to say Merry Christmas again, and that he will apparently single-handedly reverse a piece of legislation that he disagrees with. Mm-hmm.
So, Sarah, does a cynical interpretation actually offer some hope that this is all just for Trump?
I think that it's for Trump. I mean, obviously it benefits Trump, or Trump thinks it benefits him. But I think that this is also a struggle by these religious conservative leaders to maintain their relevance when they basically have a candidate who won the Republican primary without doing anything to pander to them. In fact, did a lot the opposite of pandering to them. So I think that it's kind of everybody involved with this is using it to pad their resume, if you will, mm-hmm. or bolster their relevance, because Trump made it pretty clear that he could win the primary without their help. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to convince him now that he can't win the general election without their help, but he might lose the general election despite their health. So it's kind of a complicated calculus that, like, might at the end of the day involve everybody just looking completely irrelevant, which is what they're all trying to avoid, if that makes sense.
You know, this really fits perfectly with some of the things that you've said and written in the past about why far-right religious leaders were supporting Trump. You've said that ultimately they're just sick of losing and will find a way to make a winning candidate acceptable to themselves. Is that part or all of what we saw happening last Tuesday?
What you have is a constituency that has proved in the last several election cycles to be an essential element of the Republican base. So when, for example, George W. Bush won the presidency in 2004 when he won re-election, 36% of his support, of his votes, came from white evangelicals. So obviously the Republican Party needs them, but also they need to feel needed, because if they don't feel that way or they don't have the sense that they're needed, then they've lost their ability to place pressure on a future president. So here they are trying to make themselves relevant to the election, but also potentially indispensable to President Trump, right? So if he were to win, see, if they don't support him and he were to win anyway, then he doesn't need to listen to them about judges or abortion rights or anything like that. But if they come out in force and he wins and they can make an argument that he won because they mobilized for him, then they maintain their seat at the table. So it's really about them trying to find that space where they're still relevant, and it doesn't matter to them whether he really is the sort of candidate that fits their mold or not. They make a lot of different excuses and rationalizations for why they're supporting him. And they've gotten a lot of heat from people like Mike Farris and others who are basically in the Never Trump camp.
Was there anything else in this meeting between candidate Trump and the evangelical leaders that we should highlight that haven't mentioned yet?
He was asked about immigration, and nobody really held his feet to the fire. There was no evidence that there was a strong pro-immigration reform contingent at this meeting, and there is such a contingent among evangelicals, but they didn't seem to either be there in force or their questions didn't make it through the screening that I understand happened for questions to be asked of the candidate. He paid a lot of lip service to their issues, but he also rambled a lot. If you listen to the audio recordings, which are, you know, now out there on the web, he's asked pretty specific questions, and he doesn't give very specific answers, and he wanders off a lot, and there's no follow-up, nobody's really pressing him on anything, and it's hard to believe that people with supposedly very strong convictions about these various values or issues were satisfied with some of these answers that were vague, rambling, incoherent at times. So it was pretty fascinating to see this.
What else are you paying close attention to at this point in the campaign?
Where the Never Trump evangelicals are they really going to come up with an independent candidate to run against Trump? What's their end game there? And then what's really going to happen to the evangelicals who aren't in the Never Trump camp, but they're not in the cheerleading Trump camp, and they're feeling pretty ambivalent? And whether they'd end up going with Trump because of their antipathy to Clinton, which I think is a lot of what's driving many of these evangelicals over to the Trump side. But I think that all of this will have ramifications for the movement. I think it's going to have ramifications for their cohesiveness and their previous unwillingness to publicly criticize each other. I think there's going to be more recriminations than we've seen in the past.
Sarah Posner is an investigative journalist at the intersection of religion and politics. Her writing appears in Rolling Stone, The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Huffington Post, and elsewhere. Sarah is the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Sarah, the updated version of your book is writing itself right before your eyes. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio. It's always helpful and insightful and enjoyable.
Thank you, Elton.
Last October, we heard from Dr. Martin Copenhaver, president of Andover Newton Theological School in Massachusetts, about their ambitious two-day summit titled Subverting the Gospel of Guns. It brought together faith and political leaders and activists to strategize about ways to break the deadlock on firearm policies in this country. The work has continued in the intervening months, and with the recent focus on the issue, as well as continued legislative inaction on the issue, I wanted to get an update on this week's show. Dr. Copenhaver, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
Would you just briefly refresh our memories about the original summit last fall and who it brought together and what its goals were?
Yes, it was a diverse gathering of religious leaders, civic leaders, business leaders, well, came together for 2 days to talk about what we call the gospel of guns and to reverse our dependence on guns and our idolatry of guns. Hmm. So we had the Massachusetts Attorney General, the Chief of the Boston Police, the Mayor of Boston, as well as other civic and religious leaders. It was a very powerful experience for us all. None of us left that unchanged. And so our commitment here at Andover Newton continues, although less formally than during the summit. But this is not an issue that's going to go away. It requires what the philosopher Nietzsche said, long obedience in the same direction. Mm. And that's what we're trying to do.
What have the participants of that meeting been doing? What have they been working on since then?
Well, working through our own legislative processes here, contacting our representatives in Washington. Gratefully, here in Massachusetts, we have some of the best gun control laws in the country, and as a result, one of the lowest rates of fatality in the country, but our focus has been more on what can happen in Washington and the federal government and the complete lack of action. I was very heartened, however, to see the dramatic action of representatives who took the step of having a sit-in right on the floor of Congress, led very symbolically and powerfully by John Lewis, who was a leader in the civil rights movement. And it takes that kind of proactive approach to somehow move past the deadlock.
When John Lewis got up and started talking, what were you thinking while he was talking?
Well, I was inspired. I said, this is the kind of thing that's going to be required of us. The passion on this issue has been on the part of the gun lobbies, the gun owners, and we need to match that passion with our own and to be willing to take extraordinary actions that match and better the actions that are being taken by the pro-gun lobbies. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was very stirring to have John Lewis in that position. He was, as you know, as a young man, a leader in the civil rights movement, and here he is as an older man taking up this issue with the same kind of moral integrity. It was very inspiring to me.
How do you explain the chasm between public opinion about gun safety and the congressional body's just absolute refusal to pay attention to it? It is a stark, scary thing for me to see such a chasm between public opinion and legislation or the lack thereof.
The gun manufacturers, the gun lobbies are very powerful. We have more guns in this country than we do have people. It's an extraordinary thing, singular in the world, really. I mean, our love of guns, it's amazing to me that we can't sue gun manufacturers, that they're exempt from civil lawsuits, even though drug companies and auto manufacturers are not. I mean, it's just inconceivable to me. I think that it's this very old commitment to guns that goes back, of course, to pre-colonial times and has been written in some form or another, although people disagree of what the interpretation is, in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And our whole history as a frontier people. But circumstances have changed. Our love of guns seem to have only increased, and it's the kind of idolatry that is truly dangerous.
Martin, earlier this year, you announced a new partnership with Yale Divinity School. I've been eager to hear more about that, so let me invite you to describe the plans that you have for this partnership.
We're very excited about this unfolding partnership. We have a lot of affinities, historical and cultural affinities with Yale Divinity School, and we see that this partnership is going to be able to free us to focus on our mission in a way that we can't as an independent theological school. Mm-hmm. Independent theological schools are under a great deal of stress in this time, not unlike other professional schools, mm-hmm. or even small liberal arts schools that are experiencing financial challenges related to enrollment. Mm-hmm. But we see this as a tremendous opportunity to think afresh about what's required for theological education in our time. Andover Newton, we anticipate, will be what's technically called an embedded school. That is a school within a school with both very close affiliation with Yale Divinity School, but also some elements of independence, mm-hmm. so that we can focus on our historic mission of training pastors and other religious leaders in the small C congregational traditions, that is, locally mm-hmm. governed churches. And we see the challenge of this time is having the pastors who are sufficiently educated to address the particular extraordinary challenges of this time in religious life in America. So we're refocusing our mission back to really what our founding mission was, mm-hmm. which is learned clergy who are equipped to serve congregations throughout the country. There's sadness associated with this, particularly mm-hmm. as relates to selling our campus. We've been on this site, this beautiful site that many generations have loved since 1825. Mm-hmm. There's sadness associated with that, and some of the staff that will be losing their jobs. But as far as the mission of the school and being able to fulfill that mission into the future, this development is nothing short of thrilling.
What would you like to see happen to Andover Theological School in the years ahead that would lead you as a leader to say, this is the work we were meant to do?
Yeah. Well, our students are our mission. We want to educate students who are prepared to be inspiring leaders for this time, mm-hmm. and inspiring leaders particularly in congregational settings, but in other settings as well. That mission has been what has energized us for these 209 years that the school has been here. We're the oldest theological school, actually the oldest graduate school of any kind in this country. But that's been our governing mission. It looks different now because of all the changes that are going on, but the mission is the same.
Dr. Martin Copenhaver is president of Andover Newton Theological School. He's the author of numerous books, including Room to Grow, Meditations on Trying to Live as a Christian, and Living Faith While Holding Doubts. Dr. Copenhaver, I thank you so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
It's been a pleasure.
You first met Brandon Robertson on this show in early 2014 when his insightful writing on the ongoing tensions between evangelicalism and the LGBT issues first came to our attention. And by the way, Brandon at that point was all of 21 years old. Brandon has been back with us a number of times since then, as he labored to build what he called the Revangelical movement, as he prepared to publish his first book, as he lost that book deal after coming out as gay, and now, with that book finally published and ambitious new projects underway, having just completed a speaking tour overseas. And so, Brandon, welcome back once again to State of Belief Radio.
It's so good to be with you, and thank you for all of your support over the years.
Well, thanks. First, let me wish you a happy birthday. I guess at the age of 24, it was high time for you to publish a memoir.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
This is an important and insightful book. Talk about how it finally came to be published and tell us how people can get a hold of it.
So after the book deal got canceled back in early 2015, I kind of decided that I was going to step back for a bit and not try to publish it right away. I was waiting for a few months and just started working on a new book project. And early on in the fall of 2015, I got an email from a British publisher, Darton Longman and Todd, who just said that they were really captivated by the book and really would love to try to bring it to audiences across the United Kingdom and Europe. And so I began having kind of tentative conversations, and it turns out that this publisher, Darton Longman Todd, is quite an amazing and bold voice within the Church of England and the Roman Catholic Church over in the United Kingdom. And we just had a really great relationship, and they've taken Nomad and brought it back to life. And I just got back from about a three-week tour across Ireland and the United Kingdom and just had the opportunity to really see how so much of what I wrote about in the book, about this spiritual journey of millennials to a place of spiritual but not religious, to a place of wandering, is really coming to light in their churches and in their denominations. And also how there's this growing force of inclusivity and welcome towards the LGBT community and broader communities as well. That's really happening both here in the United States and across the pond. And so I'm just so excited to have it finally out and into the world. And it's also available here in the United States on Amazon.com. So,
Brandon, for whom did you write this book? Who is the intended audience? What kind of person or people did you envision when writing it, saying, I really want to get this across to this kind of person?
Right. There were two groups as I wrote Nomad that I really was writing to and focusing on. The first would be the conservative religious community, or even just religious leaders that are kind of bewildered by what's happening in their churches and in the pews, how young people are leaving at rapid numbers across most denominations. And many, I've had so many conversations with denominations and church leaders who are just unable to figure out what to do to kind of draw back in young people. And Nomad was written as a way of telling them, actually, maybe it's not about drawing back in young people, but maybe young people aren't becoming irreligious or anti-religion, but we're rediscovering a new way of being spiritual. And then the other group is for those who identify as wanderers. And initially, I would have said that was the millennial generation as a whole. But what I've really discovered in the past few years is that this is spans generations. This isn't just a young person thing. There is a real spiritual movement happening across generations where people are moving outside of the rigid confines of structures and systems and denominations and into a spirituality that's just more integrated into the rhythms of day-to-day life. And it was meant to kind of give voice to what many people are feeling inside but may not have heard articulated in a public way. Okay. And so it's for the nomads and for those who are trying to rein in the nomads, if you will.
You write about traveling light spiritually. What do you see as heavy travel to many of us? What weights us down?
Yeah, I think the easy things are the systems and structures of religion that have become so intertwined with power and privilege and wealth. This is very much part of religion here in the United States and in the United Kingdom, where there is this intertwining of religious leaders and political leaders and corporations. And it's made spirituality this whole thing that you have to buy into, this whole system you have to buy into. And if you are honest or have questions, you run into walls of people and doctrines and rules and regulations that say, if you think that way or if you step too far beyond this boundary, you'll be exiled, there will be hell to pay. And that is not what spirituality is about. As I write in the book, it's about a posture of humility and a posture of wonder. It's about not trying to conform to the image of a system, but rather the liberation that comes when we're able to simply be who we are and ask the questions that we truly have and seek out whatever we want to and continue the journey around every corner. I really think spirituality is about this liberation, and so much of what Christianity has become is buying into the system that you have to give your whole life to or not be a part of at all. And I think that's the heaviness of religion.
Why is it, in your opinion, why is it that we tend to turn toward the weight that slows us down rather than to the light travel that lets us rise and soar?
I think it's because when we are in the heavy system of religious structure, it's really comfortable. It's a wonderful position to know that you're right on everything, to know that you have the single absolute truth and everybody else is wrong. And especially in, again, the United States and the United Kingdom, Christians are in a position of privilege over society still to this day. And so it's really easy to stay within a system that privileges you over the rest of the society and culture. Mm-hmm. And that might sound a little cynical, and I don't think people are actually consciously buying into that way. But I think those are the underlying motivations, that we want to feel like we're part of a group. We want to feel like we're at home, that we're right, that everything's taken care of, and that we don't have to continually think critically. Instead, we'd like to rely on a book that we believe has all of the answers for all of the questions. Mm-hmm. I think for most people, that works for a season of life. But when your experience begins to contradict that which you believe, I think that's where it begins to fall apart for most people.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about institutional religion, especially in Christianity, we're talking about the church. Is the institutional rather than communal nature of the church, does that make getting to the light stuff more difficult?
I think in some ways it does. I think realistically the institution will always exist, and I think it can be very helpful. The institution can function well. But I do think more often than not, especially in our day and age, the institutions are too bogged down with all these different regulations and things that you have to do. I just spent some time with a number of people in the Church of Ireland, and we were just talking about the ways that all of the regulations and systems and hierarchies of the institution, what they require of their members and of their clergy, really constrains them from being allowed to explore, from being allowed to be authentic with their spirituality. And I think if institutions are going to survive and thrive, they're really going to have to loosen up a lot of these things that have created this heaviness within them and try to find new ways of allowing people to be free in their expression, whatever that looks like.
Brendan, what did the people in the United Kingdom, the publishers in the United Kingdom, what did they see in your manuscript that really did attract them and make them want to publish the book?
Yeah, I think what they really saw is that Nomad is, I worked really hard to make it very relatable, and I do think that even though as a young person, I'm only 24, I do think, however, a lot of the lessons really do tap into and hit the nerve of what's happening in, I think, global spirituality today. I think, as one of my mentors who I dedicated the book to, Phyllis Tickle, always talked about, we're coming up on kind of a revolution that happens every 500 years, except this goes beyond Christianity. It's a global spiritual revolution that's affecting all religions. Mm-hmm. And I think Nomad just begins to touch and explain a little bit of what's happening. And it doesn't really give a vision for what the future is going to look like. I don't presume to know that. Mm-hmm. But it does kind of put into words what's happening in the hearts and souls of a lot of different people. And I think that's what compelled Darton Longman and Todd to publish it. Also the fact that they are really trying to work hard to bring reform in their own religious structure within the Church of England and the Roman Catholic Church. And so I think they were trying to be a little angsty with publishing it as well and lighting a little fire within their own tradition.
I'm curious, in your engagements, interactions with people during your travels, are people in that land or in those places, are they seeing the LGBT issues as a spiritual concern, or are they seeing it more as a cultural, social concern?
I think it's a little bit of both, and it really depended on where I was at in the United Kingdom. For instance, I spent some time in Northern Ireland and meeting with the religious leaders there, and Northern Ireland was much like the Southern United States as far as how they were engaging with the LGBT issue, and just religious leaders are timid and afraid to speak out because of what their denominations will do to them. But in so many other places around the United Kingdom and Ireland, I really found that the churches and religious institutions were largely, had already passed all the questions about civil rights, and we're now seeing this as a spiritual kind of pastoral issue, that this community of people have been harmed and rejected by the church for so long, and they're really seeking how to bring healing and also how to ensure that the gates of the church remain fully open to all people. And so I think in some regards, parts of the United Kingdom and Ireland are where we are in the United States, a bit behind on this, and other parts are a few years ahead and are really beginning, just as a whole, even more conservative religious leaders are really interested in the pastoral question and realizing how harmful some of their teaching is to the actual lives of LGBT people.
Well, that's really that's a hopeful observation from my perspective, because, as you well know, there's this stereotype that in the United Kingdom that religion is on its way out and doesn't have that much influence. But what you've said is extremely important and bodes well for what's happening in the United States. One other question about your travels: what did you find particularly memorable about this trip? When you think about it, what's going to come to mind first?
I really think the thing that was most memorable and the most refreshing thing was that for a long time I've kind of projected that the same sorts of movements that are happening here that I attribute to the Holy Spirit moving in the United States in certain ways are happening across the pond, and people all across the UK and Ireland, there's this really prevalent spiritual hunger, not only among the religious people that I was with, but at a number of my events, people that had left the church and were really resentful towards the church came, and during Q&A would be so tearful because they would say for the first time they're hearing an articulation of Christianity and spirituality that they could come back to. There's truly a hunger for a spiritual awakening, to be connected to God and connected to all people. And so, like you were just saying, the UK isn't this kind of desolate, dry, atheistic, secular land. It's actually a place where people are deeply spiritual and are really trying to find a new way to express that spirituality. And I think that was so hopeful, and I really feel like we have great partners in the United Kingdom and Ireland that we in the United States need to do better at connecting with and working together with.
Brandon, you've launched a new nonprofit called Nomad Partnerships. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Nomad Partnerships is a new nonprofit that really does two things. One, we work here in the United States to kind of elevate some of the abuses that conservative Christian denominations and organizations do towards sexual and gender minorities. And so, for instance, we hosted a conference in Denver just a few months ago called Our Witness in response to the Q conference, which was an evangelical event that spoke about LGBT issues, but from a very conservative perspective and without actual LGBT people there. And our witness, we elevated the voices of 11 nationally known LGBT Christians that shared their stories in response to the Q conference. And then the other side is we're starting to move international to work with religious leaders in places like Malawi and the Congo and in the United Kingdom to partner together and figure out how we continue to help this ball move forward of reformation, both politically for the civil rights of all people and within the church. And so over in the next 6 months or so, we'll be launching programs around the world and meeting with leaders from around the world to figure out how to help combat anti-LGBT legislation and foster inclusivity within the church.
And tell our listeners how they can keep up with you and get more information about Nomad Partnerships.
I think the easiest way is just to go to nomadpartnerships.org, and from there you can link to my personal website and learn more about what we're doing as an organization.
Brandon Robertson is a young LGBT evangelical activist. His book is titled Nomad, A Spirituality for Traveling Light. Brandon is the founder of Nomad Partnerships, and you can find out more about that at nomadpartnerships.org. Brandon, you're doing such important work. It's good to hear the optimism in your voice. It's good to know about what you're developing. It's good to know about the kind of affirmation you're getting. And I want to thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio, and I hope you know that you're welcome back here, and we'll be trying to get you back here on a regular basis.
Well, thank you so much, Walton. I just want to say I appreciate State of Belief and all that you're doing in the world so much. So thanks so much.
Now, before we go, a few thoughts of my own. Can this election cycle get any crazier and its threats any sadder or scarier? Listening to political pundits with credibility puts forward the answer to my question as yes. At this point in the campaigns, we can only wait and see. Streaming through my mind this week were other questions that can be answered with a high degree of certainty and minimal speculation. I point to two examples of my observation, each of which relates to candidate Trump's meeting with evangelicals earlier this week. First, Donald Trump lied to these evangelical leaders. He told them that we don't have religious freedom in our nation. Not only is that not true, it is a revelation either of this candidate's ignorance about our nation or his the end justifies any means strategy of sacrificing truth to win votes. Historians agree that the assurance of religious freedom in our Constitution is one of this nation's greatest gifts to the world. Yes, it's embattled. Yes, right now, people wanting a prejudicial bent toward Christianity are seeking to change the meaning of the First Amendment. But the last time I looked, that amendment was still in place, anchoring the Bill of Rights. Officials on both sides of the aisle in Congress, an aisle that this past week has been filled with congressional protesters seeking a vote on gun safety, have reaffirmed their commitment to religious freedom and expressed their strong disagreement with candidate Trump's proposal that domestic and foreign policies discriminate on the basis of religious identity and to prioritize efforts to make Christianity once again the dominant religion in our democracy. Don't buy the lie. Winning an election never should be achieved by weakening our Constitution. If candidates cannot see that truth, voters must see that truth and remind them of its reality. And second, during that same gathering, Trump sought to enlist leaders of the religious right in his quest for winning the presidency. Now, of course, we've known since the inception of the religious right that it is a political organization, not a religious movement. In fact, this year, leaders of the religious right, like Jerry Falwell Jr., have come out of the political closet and said with great clarity that their support for Donald Trump is not about religion. Franklin Graham even dared to excuse Donald Trump for all of his moral errors that could compromise his potential for leadership, saying that major sins occur in everyone's life. Yeah, that's true. But if you trace the tirades of Graham across the years, he has condemned harshly the behavior that is a part of Trump's resume. Michael Farris is one of the most influential evangelical leaders in our nation. He was present at the launch of the Christian Coalition, and he's been identified with evangelical Christianity since the inception of his work. After watching what happened in candidate Trump's meeting with evangelical leaders, Farris wrote that this meeting was a forerunner to the end of the Christian right. Farris, Chancellor of Patrick Henry College, wrote to the Christian Post, "I strongly dissent from the wisdom of the chosen path made public in the meeting. Today," Farris wrote of the event, "a candidate whose worldview is greed and whose God is his appetites is being tacitly endorsed by this throng. They are saying we are Republicans no matter what the candidate believes and no matter how vile and unrepentant his character." Farris called the religious leaders assembled by Trump not a phalanx of God's prophets confronting a wicked leader, but a parade of elephants. Farris concluded his article stating his dismay that politics were singularly influencing these religious leaders and observing this is a day of mourning. We cannot ignore these words of truth coming straight from the mind of a highly respected leader of the Christian right, who knows the Christian right perhaps better than anyone else. Yes, the Christian right, following Donald Trump, represents an army ready to sacrifice religious liberty for a mess of political porridge. I disagree with Michael Farris on only one point. I don't think this is the end of the Christian right. Since the late 1970s, I've been following closely the development and organization of this movement. Never has it relented, even when moving in disguise or, as one of its early leaders said, embodying a stealth strategy that hides its identity until its opponents are in body bags. For all these years, with regularity, eulogies for the Christian right have been read, but there was no corpse. Stay vigilant, my friends. Truth is not yet secure, and religious freedom is under assault in this election cycle. I do agree with Michael Farris that what we saw take place this past week in Trump Tower was for all supportive of our democracy and the religious freedom that is its anchor, a cause for saying this really was a day of mourning. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. Some of you wrote this week along with your donation, and I really do appreciate that. We'd like to hear from you, so drop us a note anytime you wish. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share that with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that's grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was. Mm-hmm.